You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
To Connecting the Dots, I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with my buddy, Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, author of Four Witnesses. Rod Bennett, author of The Apostasy That Wasn't. Rod Bennett, author of Chesterton's America. Rod Bennett, author of The Christus Experiment.
The hits keep coming.
The hits keep coming. Just a towering figure, and
6 foot one, as a matter of fact.
6 foot one. Yes.
Although I'm soon to be dwarfed. I've got Gary Mishuta coming to spend the night at my house next week.
He's on his way
to do an appearance in EWTN, and okay. I just happened to be right on his way, so okay. I extended an invitation to come here and spend the night on the old homestead. And he's going to stop and spend the night. And Gary, you know, is about 9 feet tall, so.
Yeah, I mean, that guy's a giant. He really is.
Have you met him in person?
Yeah. Yes, he's enormous.
So, and he's an enormous intellect, too, so that's great.
You know, that reminds me of a story. This happened years ago. You know how little boys are. Little boys go through these various phases of interest in things, passionate interest. So there's, you know, the Star Wars phase and the Bionicles phase. And
I'm still stuck in the Star Wars phase. So.
Star Wars phase. Yeah. And, you know, the Viking phase and the soldier phase and, you know, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And our kids went through the detective phase.
Ah.
When they were, you know, Peter was about eight, and I think Sean was around.
What would Sherlock Holmes do in a case like this?
Yeah. And so they would do this, and so their aunt and uncle would come over in the what was called the spy car. I'm not really sure how it got the name the spy car, but anyway, they would come over in the spy car, and then they would have them over to their house, and they would set these puzzles for them to solve. Mystery puzzles for them to solve while they were doing the detective thing. And then when they figured out the puzzle, then, you know, then it was time for cookies and milk or whatever.
Once they figured out who done it.
Well, yeah, once they figured it out. So anyway, Peter was in the thick of the detective phase. And I have a friend named Mike. His wife is Catholic, and he was not, but he was looking at becoming Catholic. And Mike is like 7 feet tall. He's just this colossal guy. And so they came over to our house one Sunday afternoon because it was Lent and he was going to be entering the church and he had questions and he wanted to talk. I said, great. So they come over and I'm sitting there talking to Mike. I wasn't paying attention to Pete. And Pete comes and sits down next to me. On the couch while I'm talking to Mike, and he's got his little flip book, as you do when you're a detective, with the little number two golf pencil, where he would jot down his notes and clues that he was thinking about. And something distracted him, as was his custom, and so he dropped the little notebook and the little number two pencil on the couch and wandered off, and we had our afternoon and ate our dinner, and everybody left, and then it was time to pick up all the debris because Mike's little girls had come over, and so between our kids and his girls, there was a lot of debris all over the house. And so our oldest son, Luke, who you know, Rod.
Sure.
Luke was... part of the pickup cleanup task force. And so he's going through the living room picking up all the junk that's everywhere that the kids left behind. And he finds the little flip book sitting on the couch. And he opens the flip book and he glances at it and he bursts out laughing. And he says, Dad, check this out. So he hands me the flip book. Peter has written in his 8-year-old scrawl, he has written, name Mike, hair brown, eyes blue, And then below that, he writes, strangely and suspiciously tall.
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. Anybody that tall has got to be up to no good.
Got to be something going on there. Yeah. So I never got this story. I love that story.
So I'll tell Gary when he gets here that he's strangely and suspiciously tall.
Excellent. Yes, please. Give him my regards. That's just so great. Well, today, we're going to take a little course change from all the, you know, there's been so much exhausting talk about what freakish thing Trump or his minions have done today. And it's just kind of like, you know, okay, we could talk about that, but instead we're not.
We need to take a holiday. You and I both decided before the show that a little bit of a respite might do us both some good.
Yes. And there are other things going on in the world. And one of the many great things that has gone on in the world is the creation of just great movies. And one of the greatest movies, I think, ever made it works that magic that movies are supposed to work.
Yep.
At their best, is the greatest, and I think Rod would agree, the greatest science fiction movie of the 1950s. The 1950s were like a bumper crop. That's when science fiction movies really took off.
Well, it's interesting how explosive that was as compared to the previous decade.
Yeah.
Science fiction's almost... MIA during the 1940s.
Right.
It's alarming how few science fiction movies were made during that period. A few little things, serials for kids, you know, things of that type.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, after World War II, and well, actually the year 1950, there's this explosion of science fiction movies, and I've got my own theories about why this happened, but it suddenly became the number one genre in a way that similar to what superheroes did.
In the 20s, science fiction starts to take off as a literary phenomenon, particularly with the advent of things like Amazing Stories and so forth. So you find a lot of written science fiction starting to happen in the 20s. In the 30s, there's this moment where you get a couple of things. For example, Buck Rogers. And Flash Gordon,
mostly for kids, based on Sunday funnies.
Right, based on Sunday funnies, and Buck Rogers is science fictiony, but really it's like Star Wars. Star Wars isn't really science fiction; it just has some of the trappings.
Well,
of
as
science.
A matter of fact, George Lucas made Star Wars because he originally wanted to do Flash Gordon, and he couldn't get the rights.
Ah,
so
okay.
He said. Well, maybe we could come up with our own variation on that.
Make our own universe.
That's when that whole thing was born.
Yeah.
But yes, so Flash Gordon is full of medieval castles in space and princesses and black knights and all of that kind of thing. And so
it
very much
to,
one of the roots of Star Wars.
It really owes more to Edgar Rice Burroughs, I think, than it does to science fiction. And, we hear things like Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars stories, but Mars is basically just, here's a faraway place, we'll have our adventure there. But it really, that's not science fiction, you know.
Right.
And so you get sort of a little bit, but the technology doesn't really exist in the movies in the 30s science fiction.
Also, there is a little bit of a boom, but it's mostly used for a horror effect in the 30s.
Yeah.
The science fiction movies that did come out during that decade are mostly horror SF. Mm-hmm. So, it's used in things like, Dr. X and, well, Frankenstein's really got a science fiction element to it. So,
yeah, it does.
But, yeah, it's the horror was the thing in that decade. So,
that's thrillers.
Yeah.
So, H.G. Wells gets a couple of Things to Come, The Invisible Man.
That's probably the most intelligent science fiction movie of that era. even though it's pretty naive as far as the philosophy goes, as some of the written H.G. Wells is. But it's a spectacular movie, and certainly got the best special effects of its era.
And you get, you know, one thing that's sometimes cited as a science fiction movie, although, again, I'm not buying it, is Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Right. It's, which is really... you can define science fiction more or less strictly.
Right. Well, it's got a robot, you know.
Yep.
And
it does.
In the future somewhere.
But the robot is made by, like, a weird medieval-looking wizard in a...
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, and this sort of black magic ceremony. So I see your point.
but in terms of the cinematic science fiction, it really does just, there's just this kaboom about 1950. Yeah.
I think part of my own personal theory is that that the average person didn't have enough science for science fiction to be big before that. In other words, if you look at the letters pages in early SF magazines, they get some of the craziest letters from people that, you know, ask questions, you know, ask whether the stories are really true or not, or I mean, it's a very odd experience to read these early letters pages. And I generally think that the public just simply didn't understand enough science yet. It hadn't filtered down to the average farm family for SF to be anything but a niche at that time. But, of course, after World War II, you've seen incredible advances in practical technology.
We're up against a break, Rod, so we'll have to continue after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots, and we'll be back right after this with Rod Bennett talking about Forbidden Planet.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. Thought we'd take just a little divergence to some fun stuff. We're talking. Thought we'd spend a little time today talking about Forbidden Planet. We've spent the last segment kind of situating Forbidden Planet in the history of the movies a little bit, in the history of American culture, science fiction.
Right now, the id monster's attacking, and that's one of the great moments. Huh? I may drift in and out of the conversation, Mark. Sorry. No, I'll try to keep my mind on my work. Actually, I've seen Forbidden Planet 100 times probably, so I should be able to keep my mind on my work.
All right, very good. So we're saying just before we went to break that there was this very sudden explosion of interest in science fiction in the mid-1950s.
The year is 1950. The first movie is a movie called Rocket Ship XM, which was a cheap knockoff rush to beat the much-publicized first movie of the era, which was going to be George Pal's Destination Moon. And Rocket Ship XM was rushed into production to make a similar movie and get it into the theaters first, and it gains the... distinction of being the first 50 science fiction movie. But it was made in late 1949 and came out in early 1950. So it really is, when it turned 1950, that was the starting gun.
I think that there's a couple of things that are behind that. One is what was necessary, of course, was for the generation that grew up reading Amazing Stories
right.
And all of that. You know, when that generation has enough money in its pockets,
right,
to buy amazing.
I was going to say the break that the even mom and dad had seen the atomic bomb and the V-2 rocket by this point.
Right.
And I think those things made a tremendous impression on people.
Yeah.
The future is now, you know.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, both of those things were, you know, just not imaginable just a few years earlier.
Well,
just as the Cold War sort of drug the space age forward by several decades, I think, pressures of the Cold War.
Right.
Pressures of World War II brought all of these super weapons into existence, and science was given a real kick in the butt. And because people watched it all on the news, it was on their minds, you know.
Right. And one of the things that you see, for example, I just watched Destination Moon last night, as a matter of fact.
How about that? Also a good movie.
Yeah, it's loads of fun. Made in 1953, back when they knew how to make rockets that looked the way rockets were supposed to look.
We're talking about Destination Moon?
Destination Moon.
Yeah. Came out in 1950, actually.
Okay. I'm sorry.
One of the movies I'm talking about. 1950. It was really very early.
Okay. And what's interesting about this movie, there's a couple of things that are interesting about this movie. This is made back when America is the sole industrial colossus left on the face of the earth after World War II.
Right.
Where we have unbounded confidence in what American industry working with the government can achieve. And so you get this presentation at the beginning about why do we need to go to the moon? And first of all, you get the science explained by Woody Woodpecker.
Right. Which is pretty brilliant. They brought in Universal's. Woody Woodpecker was Universal's poor man's Mickey Mouse.
Right.
And so they Universal loaned out Woody Woodpecker to appear in the sort of educational film that we got used to seeing from people like Walt Disney.
Exactly.
To explain the science.
What's fascinating about it, of course, is that this film has to be made at all, that this short film has to be made at all, because it's very clear that nobody understands how a rocket works. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to have this.
Well, that's it. It's hard for us to believe now, you and I that grew up in the 60s watching hours and hours of Walter Cronkite bringing out models and stuff to explain it all, you know.
Right.
The whole country lived through that experience, and so we understand that we don't have to be told, you know, why a rocket works and all these things.
Right.
But this generation, you know, they grew up behind a plow, you know.
Yeah.
And they got a little science in public school, but it didn't get real speculative, you know. So, the degree to which the public of 1950 needed very basic stuff explained to them is one of the things that stands out in that movie.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, you know, they have to explain that there's no air in space. And things that, you know, we today listen to and go, seriously, that needed to be explained? But of course it did.
Yeah.
People didn't have any reason to know this stuff. So why should they? And so you get this explanation. But what's also fascinating, of course, is the explanation that's given for why we have to go to the moon. And it is entirely a Cold War explanation, which today we listen to and we go,
people's minds in 1950.
People really were afraid about this. So the reason that's given for why we have to go to the moon is that the first nation that lands on the moon will
now they've got the high ground, haven't they?
A fortress. They've got the high ground, and they're going to be able to launch missiles from the moon and rain down destruction
on
America.
Overpass.
And so there's no
as Lyndon Johnson says in the right stuff.
We are defenseless against Mr. President. We must not have a moon gap. You know?
Right.
And so that's really the argument that's put forward.
Well, that's
and,
what drove
which
the real
sounds
moon
incredibly
mission.
Weird to us today, of course, but it was What's that?
When the real moon mission came. That's why we got to the moon in 1969. We'd probably still be trying to get there if it weren't for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's how science fiction begins. It's very much in a Cold War setting. But by the by 1956, we get to this really remarkable departure of Forbidden Planet. And I was wondering if you could just maybe take a little time and kind of do the outline of Forbidden Planet for people who have not seen it.
Okay. Forbidden Planet's really the origin of, in some way, Star Trek. Maybe the best shorthand for me to give you is that it's like a Star Trek episode. It was, 10 years before Star Trek, and Star Trek is to some degree a Forbidden Planet knockoff. But you've got the young, good-looking, headstrong captain of a saucer-shaped starship who is part of a United Federation of Planets who gets sent out to the planet Altair 4 to investigate a missing professor, or actually a missing expedition of which this professor was part. And they get to his planet. They find that he's the only surviving member. And there is a mystery to be solved. What happened to the other members of the expedition? Did the professor knock them off? And of course, the mystery deepens when members of the captain's own crew begin to get bumped off one by one. So it's kind of a mystery, and it ends up having a very cosmic explanation. And it's a very, very intelligent movie, remarkably so. The science still holds up today, and it should, because the script was thoroughly vetted by MIT physics professors, and it's remarkable in that way.
I did not know that. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Also, a good shorthand.
A lot of people don't know.
Some of our friends may remember the one with Robbie the Robot. So,
okay. One of the things that I was not aware of at first, the first time I saw it, was that the story is based loosely on The Tempest.
Very loosely. You hear that loosely from time to time. It's based on The Tempest the same way that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is based on the on Homer.
On the Odyssey. It is pretty loosely based.
Yeah, but it's a few elements. People who know that sort of story will pick up on it, but it's a bit of whoever first published that thing, it sort of took off and has maybe gotten a stronger life than it really rates, because it's only a very, very loose connection.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting to me is that this is a film that one of the things that people in the West are struggling with after World War II, and you see it expressed in a bunch of different ways. One of them is in this film. Another one of the ways that it's expressed is in William Golding's Lord of the Flies. And it's simply the question of the problem of evil.
Right.
What you see in Destination Moon, for example, is we're the good guys. We will achieve this great thing because we're the good guys, and we must stop the bad guys. But in Forbidden Planet, the bad guy turns out to be a lot closer to home.
That's a good way.
We'll be back with Rod Bennett talking about Forbidden Planet right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be back in just a minute.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
connect the dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Nerd Supreme, Rod Bennett.
That's a pretty tall title these days. I'm the Supreme, but
a badge of honor, if I may say so. If you are a nerd, if you're an aspiring nerdling, you want to join the conversation, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and join the conversation. We're talking about Forbidden Planet. And I think the thing that Forbidden Planet really brings to the mix is a real – this is one of the major expressions of the great anxiety about original sin that
right.
World War II in particular provoked.
That's a good call.
It was MacArthur, after World War II, who is expressing, his fear at the time, that as Albert Einstein, also said, his great fear was that the next war would be the last war, that whatever war we fight next, the war after that will be fought with sticks and stones because that's all that's going to be left.
Given the scale of World War II. And given the weapon that it ended with, pretty reasonable idea.
Reasonable idea, and something that our generation, alas, has forgotten. We have not experienced. Warfare as we experience it now is something that happens on TV, and it's presented to us as a video game.
Right.
And when our soldiers come back, they are greeted with silence. A million of them came home and had no jobs, and we didn't care. Too bad, and that whole experience of war is now very different. And so we've got, for example, unfortunately, I have to get back to him. We've got a president now who has multiple times, apparently, in conversations, in briefings before his election, was asking, why can't we use nuclear weapons? That should scare the hell out of us. Somebody who's asking that question. That is something that neither Nixon nor Kennedy would ever have asked that because they'd lived through World War II. They had seen what happened. And the idea that we now have an entire generation of people who knew not Joseph, they have no experience of this, it puts us in grave danger. And one of the things that generation, the generation that made Forbidden Planet, is acutely aware of.
Right, right. One of the things that's most striking about Forbidden Planet, especially compared to many other SF stories, is that a good portion of SF is predicated on the infinite perfectibility of man, the idea that progress and evolution are going to just keep doing their magic and that things are going to get better and better in every way, and just kind of naturally, and that you're going to just become a saint without any effort. So you might as well sort of eat, drink, and be merry because it's happening naturally. Yeah. And Forbidden Planet is deeply, deeply skeptical of this. This may have spoilers in it, but I guess the movie's 60-something years old, so we don't have to worry about spoilers.
It's older than I am,
But basically, they discover that the planet that they come to, Altair 4, was once the home of a nearly divine, they call it, race that reached such a pinnacle of high benevolence that they forgot that they did have a dark pull downward, the pull of the flesh, so to speak. In the movie, it's expressed at times in Freudian language. The idea that we forgot our baser selves, we forgot the primitive origin, the sin nature, Christians would call it. And so the Krell, the name of this ancient race, got too big for their boots. They thought, even though they were very saint-like, they forgot that they weren't, after all, gods. So they built a machine that allowed their baser instincts to take over the world and eventually destroyed them, and ends up almost destroying our heroes in the story too. So it is a story about disbelief in original sin, basically. People who forgot that, thought that they were better than they really were.
Yeah, and, you know, two, 3 years before the movie was made, a book is published that makes exactly the same argument and is the fruit of a mind that has been ruminating exactly on the problem of our own capacity for evil, and it's called The Lord of the Rings. And in that, you know, what the great machine in Forbidden Planet does is much the same thing that the ring does. Not quite the same, but very similar. What it does is it says, here, I will give you godlike powers to do whatever it is that you want. And what inevitably emerges is that
what that offer should do is scare you to death.
Right.
But it doesn't usually.
But it doesn't, you know. And so, you know, the ring promises to make Middle Earth great again. the great machine promises that it will enable you to, without any instrumentality, you will simply be able to project your thoughts and desires wherever you want, with limitless power behind
it. You want a beautiful house? Think one up, and the machine will make it appear on the hillside in front of you. Not an illusion. A house.
Right. And what comes out of it, of course, is that the machine taps into deeper places in the psyche than its creators were aware that they had. And so this, as Professor Morbius calls it, this all but divine race is obliterated in a single night. And the great mystery is, how did they die? What killed them all off? And it was themselves. They destroyed themselves because all of their hates, all of their private grudges and everything that they kept under wraps, all of that was suddenly empowered. And of course that's what the ring does. And what this movie is warning us about is exactly that. Our quest for power, that the fallen human race's quest for power, is always disordered because left to ourselves, we will not seek power in order to serve the good. We will seek power in order to get more power.
Right. Sometimes movies that are trying to be scary tap into fears that people have that they may only be semi-conscious of.
Right.
I think one of the things that made The Exorcist such a huge deal in the early 70s was that this was not long after the Second Vatican Council. And the Second Vatican Council, not in what it actually said, but in how it was pitched in certain corners, was viewed by a lot of people as the starting gun for a new kind of Catholicism where, you know, something that used to be absolutely evil, that is, eating meat on Friday, could suddenly change overnight, you know. So as a result, and with a little encouragement in some places, there was a kind of a free-for-all in American Catholicism in the late 60s and early 70s. And a lot of people who had been terribly, in touch with their guilty conscience before this, suddenly felt what they thought was the permission to go out and have a fling and sow some wild
blow
oats.
It all off.
And after a few years of that, I think that they were a little bit edgy about what they'd done. And then suddenly The Exorcist comes along, and it's a movie about a kind of fallen away priest who has let himself go, and more than one in the film. And all of a sudden, he gets thrown into this battle with the devil, and it turns out it's all true.
Mm-hmm.
All that scary stuff that the nuns taught you in Catholic school is all real, and you've let yourself go, and you're not equipped to handle it anymore. And so I think that one of the reasons that movie was so terrifying is that there was a big population of sort of fallen away Catholics still in the country, and they made up a pretty good portion of the audience for the movie, and I think it tapped into deep-seated worries that they were only consciously quasi-aware of. And I think, if you'll allow me to continue the parallel, I think Forbidden Planet does the same thing. Forbidden Planet is just a few years after, maybe 3 years, put into production right after we introduced not the atomic bomb, but the hydrogen bomb. And the Soviets got their hydrogen bomb. So this topic of can humans really be trusted with this level of power?
Right.
You know, wasn't there something in our old philosophy and theology that people
exactly
like
right.
us are not able to handle godlike power? Wasn't that a pretty common theme, you know?
Oh, yeah, indeed.
And,
yeah.
I think that's behind Forbidden Planet. It was on people's minds, this topic of are we really progressed as we think we are?
We're up against the break now, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett talking about Forbidden Planet, and we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about Forbidden Planet. If you've never seen Forbidden Planet, golly, you really should. It's just such a, it is the best science fiction movie of the 1950s. There are two really great science fiction films that were made in the, there was a lot of really lousy ones that were made in the 50s.
Interestingly enough, the first half of the 50s, a good many of them are good. In other words, they got bigger, they had bigger budgets, they had, it still wasn't a big enough phenomenon, science fiction, still wasn't understood by the average person well enough for it to be a major genre in the sense of, you know, like a Western or something. It was still a little bit fringy, more interesting for young people. But the ones from the early 50s, like the original version of The Thing, directed by Howard Hawks, very prestigious. Actually, he didn't direct it, but that's another story for another day.
You're right.
Day the Earth Stood Still is one that people think of.
That was the other one that I was thinking of.
The original War of the Worlds, one that Ray Bradbury wrote the script for, a movie called It Came from Outer Space. Of the ones from the early 50s are actually pretty prestigious and intelligent. Forbidden Planet was the first one that actually got an A budget. MGM made Forbidden Planet, and they waited 5 or 6 years to get into the sci-fi thing just because they were the most prestigious studio, and they never did anything small. So they waited until they had a subject that they felt like they could do without debasing themselves. So one of the reasons the movie's as classy and intelligent as it is because MGM made it, and they spent money and wrote a script that wouldn't embarrass Mr. Mayer. So that's one of the reasons. But
it
interestingly,
also has...
after Forbidden Planet, the thing had peaked, and even though there were a lot more science fiction movies to come, the bad ones, the low budget bad ones, started to outweigh the good ones, and even though there were still a few wonderful things left, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Incredible Shrinking Man, still several very intelligent movies afterwards, but it had passed its peak by the time of Forbidden Planet.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, you mentioned earlier, Forbidden Planet is kind of the forebearer of Star Trek, that it has a lot, not all, but a lot of the things that that distinguish Star Trek. You know,
yeah. So it's got a doctor who's a little more earthy and prone to throw out a proverb every now and then. Who is right. The captain's right hand man. Right. And it's got a lot of the things. There's even a transporter effect in it. So they don't actually have a transporter, but they've got kind of these stasis tubes that have a similar look to them.
Yeah, and it's got, you know, the captain who's the chick magnet. And
particular chick is not all that hard to get at first.
That's true. And the scary, you know, there's the scary monster and all of those things. What's interesting is that Star Trek is conceived and written by somebody who, on the one hand, shares, because he's a veteran of World War II, shares this foreboding about human fallenness. And so we do see Star Trek stories in which the human capacity for evil is really taken seriously. On the other hand, Roddenberry is somebody who is an American cockeyed optimist.
Right.
Who's, he's the sky's the limit. We're going to conquer the universe.
You may be making him a little more complex than he is. He wasn't absolutely in control of Star Trek. So the episodes that seem to have a bit more of their feet on the ground from the Christian perspective are actually done by other people. When Gene got full control of a Star Trek series, as you see in the first season of Star Trek, The Next Generation, it is some of the wackiest optimism in science fiction. So much so that it's pretty odious to most people, no matter what their philosophical leanings.
Yeah, and he's given to preaching. But it's what's interesting, though, is that you do get episodes like Where No Man Has Gone Before, which in many ways is
same idea again,
all over again. Yeah, this is a Forbidden Planet episode, you know, where someone is given godlike powers and goes nuts, you know.
Yep. The id gets in charge pretty quick.
And that's so it's interesting to watch that development happening. And once you get past the era, kind of the golden age era of the 50s, when you get into the 60s, there's a lot of science fiction that's done, almost done to death, where we really do. You know, it's like the id is constantly in charge, right? Terrible things are always happening, you know? So you get a whole series of dystopian science fiction stories.
There's a little bit of a lull. The actual last real 50 science fiction movie is Robinson Crusoe on Mars. Actually, a pretty good movie. That came out in 1964, but it's still a 50 science fiction movie.
Yeah, it really is.
And the genre migrated to TV at that point. Lost in Space and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and that sort, and Star Trek in the mid 60s.
But then
it gets pretty rare for a while. 2001 comes out in 1968.
Well,
but then, yes, a new generation has arisen in the age of the cautionary science fiction movie comes into being. Stuff like Silent Running and where the last humanity is about to blow up the last trees on Earth, even though they're not on Earth anymore.
Yeah, and Planet of the Apes,
like
Fahrenheit 451, and besides Silent Running, there's the Omega Man.
Yeah.
It's funny. Richard Matheson wrote I Am Legend, which is this. It's basically the question he's asking is, you know, so suppose we evolve as a species into something that likes to prey on the, you know. The survivors of what we call Homo sapiens, who are the good guys in this story? And so he writes this story called I Am Legend. It's basically you've seen this story because Vincent Price made it in The Last Man on Earth, and Charlton Heston remade it as the Omega Man. And then a little while later, Will Smith did it again.
Yeah, the whole Night of the Living Dead is the one that really set it off. Night of the Living Dead is a slight variation on I Am Legend.
Right.
And that basically the I Am Legend, Richard Matheson's I Am Legend story of the 50s, it becomes the basis for the zombie apocalypse genre, which is, believe it or not, still going strong here in 2017.
Still with us. And yeah. Of course, those
larger
stories
than ever.
And those stories all speak of tremendous anxiety. Every one of those stories is a story that is expressive of the deep, deep anxiety that we feel about our capacity to really destroy ourselves. You know, in the 60s, the way we were going to destroy ourselves was nuclear. These days, the way we're going to destroy ourselves is biological. Although we may see a comeback of the nuclear genre as the Trump administration continues to act crazy.
What are you saying, Mark?
but it does come back to the fact that in the middle of the 20th century, for the very first time, the human race acquired the power to do the kinds of things that Christian biblical imagery had warned could happen.
Melting with fire and
and so
all of that.
People, it was almost inevitable that a Christian civilization, of course, would look at itself and say, "Dear God, what are we capable of?" And
are we trustworthy with this kind of thing?
Are we trustworthy?
Can I really be trusted with this power?
Right. You know, Abraham Lincoln couldn't destroy the world. All the czars of Russia could never have destroyed the world.
Even Hitler couldn't.
Even
one
Hitler
of the reasons
could not have destroyed the world.
That the Holocaust left any victims alive in the world that Hitler hated was because he simply was faced with an industrial problem. That it's very, very difficult industrial task to get rid of that many people.
Right. And but now
takes
we
too
have
much
the capacity
time,
to do
you
it.
Know, not
and
enough
so,
trucks and et cetera.
What Forbidden Planet is expressing, and all the other science fiction movies after about 1950, so many of them are looking at this question of how could we destroy ourselves? So we do get looks at sort of atomic energy's possibilities. In movies like Them, for example, which also begin to take up the question of biological.
Yeah, the sense of the common thread is the sense of the genie's been let out of the bottle.
Right. And
if you'll remember, the story of the guy who lets the genie out of the bottle doesn't end well for the guy that opens the cork.
Right.
Well, actually, it does, to tell you the truth. I think he tricks the genie into going back in.
Oh, well.
But maybe that's the happy ending version.
Yeah. Well, and most of the, to be fair, most science fiction movies have tended to have some kind of hopeful redemptive ending. But now and then you get, you get stories like On the Beach where, everyone's dead. Or Dr. Strangelove, Oh, rats, we're out of time. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, thank you so much for listening in out there in Radio Land. Toodaloo.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.